Welcome to the decision on RIIO ED1 market return methodology conference call on the 17th of February 2014. Throughout today's presentation, all participants will be in listen-only mode. After the presentation, there will be the opportunity to ask questions. If any participant has difficulty hearing the presentation, please press the star followed by the zero on your phone for operator assistance. I will now hand the conference over to Andrew Wright. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon. Welcome to this Ofgem conference call. I'm Andrew Wright. I'm the Interim Chief Executive of Ofgem. I'm joined by Iain Rowson, the Associate Director for Regulatory Finance, Anna Rottington, who's leading the RIIO ED1 project, and Harry Rippon from our Investor Relations team. Today, we've announced the outcome of our cost of equity consultation in relation to the RIIO ED1 price controls for the electricity distribution companies in Great Britain. This was prompted by the Competition Commission's provisional determination on Northern Ireland electricity, which was published just a few days before the announcement of our decision on fast-tracking. We've considered the evidence in more detail. We've consulted with our own experts, and we've also considered the responses to this consultation. We've decided to revise our methodology in a way that gives more weight to contemporary market evidence, which is broadly consistent with the Competition Commission's approach. As a result, we've set our baseline assumption for the cost of equity for electricity distribution companies at 6%, and that's a reduction of 6.3% on the level that we announced at the time of fast-tracking. This decision recognizes some key differences between the context of the Competition Commission decision for Northern Ireland and the context of RIIO ED1, most notably on the treatment of the cost of debt and the length of the price control. When combined with the projected indexed cost of debt, remembering that we do index cost of debt in RIIO, this implies a weighted average cost of capital for 2015-16 in the first year of the price control of around about 3.8%. If you remember, back in November, we considered the business plans of the six electricity distribution companies, and we rejected all but one of them as being unsuitable for the fast-track process. And this was because they did not represent sufficient value for money for consumers. These five companies have to resubmit business plans in March, and we're minded to use this cost of equity of 6% when considering these plans under the slow-track process. The one company that we decided was suitable for the fast-track process was WPD. WPD will now have to agree to reflect an equivalent reduction of 0.3% in its assumed return on equity if it's to remain in the fast-track process. If it does not, it will have to join the slow-track process with the other five companies. The decision to fast-track WPD was itself subject to consultation, and we intend to announce the outcome of that at the end of next week, which will take into account WPD's response to the decision. I'm going to leave it there. I know you've probably got plenty of answers, but questions, but I will now hand you back to the host for your Q&A. Thank you.
Thank you. If any participant would like to ask a question, please press the star followed by the one on your telephone. If you wish to cancel this request, please press the star followed by the two. Your questions will be polled in the order they are received, and there will be a short pause while you poll for a question. The first question comes from Jamie Tunnicliffe from Redburn. Please go ahead.
Yes, hello. I was just wondering about the consistency between, you know, doing some future work on introducing a cost of equity index and what you say in the document about advisers, you know, arguing, and we accept that the equity market return does not necessarily decline with the risk-free rate. Is that something that you see as consistent?
Yes, this is Iain Rowson. Yes, we have had identified the potential innovation of a cost of equity index, and that in part recognised that a key driver for the cost of equity for these businesses, to the extent that they are a lower, less exposed to systematic risk than the generality of businesses in the market, a key driver was the risk-free rate. And a risk-free rate, in contrast to the equity risk premium, is reasonably observable. I think we have identified there is a tension perhaps between the advice that we've received from Stephen Wright and Andrew Smithers and the position taken by the Competition Commission. I would put it no stronger than tension, but that has that looking through and trying to analyse that tension has led us to the view that our preference would be to rely more on objective information, observable information around the risk-free rate. And so the thinking behind that, and in particular the thesis set out by Stephen Wright and Andrew Smithers, would sit with that. But clearly at this stage it's far too early to introduce that for RIIO ED1. This for us is work that we need to bring in to play after ED1 is concluded.
And just to confirm that, I mean, this is work that we will do. I think the fact that we've talked about some of the issues that we may want to consider in further work after ED1, should be seen as absolutely no more than that. I think these are issues we need to look into further. I wouldn't want you to see that as an indication of anything other than what we've actually said, which is this is something we want to look at further. Okay.
Thank you. The next question comes from Dominic Nash from Macquarie. Please go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon. A couple of questions, please. Firstly, on the you're minded to have this issue of return of equity in the interim determinations. I mean, obviously, you've spent a lot of time and effort going through this consultation. How likely is it that the interim determination is going to differ from this 6%? And can we, as analysts, sort of take it 6% as a mark in the sand? And secondly, on the 0.3% cut that you're giving WPD, that obviously drops down from 6.7 to 6.4, but I think what you're basically saying is that everybody else is going from 6.7 down to 6. Is it because you're giving WPD the RPI indexation benefit on that one, please?
Right, but I'll let Ian Rosen answer that in a second. It's just fair to say, I mean, we're talking about a minded to view that we use as the reference cost of equity, the 6%, but just to remember that, well, first of all, clearly it has to be a minded to view at this stage in the process, secondly, that if the companies submit their business plans, if they want to make a case let's say, having a business plan which has a justification for a higher cost of equity, then it's certainly within their rights to make that argument, but they have to make a good case. And we're talking here very much about, you know, the reference cost of equity, rather than it is really for the companies to put forward their business plans at this stage.
Yeah, I would echo that. I think the key issues is that we've got to, it's a minded to, subject to further evidence. That evidence may come from companies, it may come from other sources, but clearly we are not in a position of making a decision at this time. When we've considered that further, any further evidence that emerges before our final conclusions later in this year, then we'll reach a decision at that time. How likely it will be to differ from 6% is difficult to say. It might be higher, it might be lower. At this stage, we can't possibly say. On your second question, which relates to the position of WPD, the way I think we've presented this in our right from the time of our fast-track decision back in November is that we assess all the business plans against the central reference point of 6.3%. Now, it happened that WPD's business plans we found acceptable, notwithstanding the fact that they went for 6.7% cost of equity assumption, but they at the same time they had very tough assumptions for other cost components. It's taking all of those cost components together that we consider they were acceptable. I don't think we're seeing it that we're giving them any more. Our reference point was 6.3%, and we are looking for them to reduce their cost of equity assumption by 0.3% to reflect our change in methodology. I hope that answers your question.
Kind of, so you are essentially giving them sort of 6.4, although you're going to sort of allocate into a sort of separate bucket, I presume.
No, I mean, another way of looking at it, I mean, expressing the same thing in another direction. If WPD delivers in line with the top quartile efficiency, then they will get a return on equity under the previous cost of equity 6.3%, now 6%. Because their business plan delivers significantly more than that, both in terms of the cost efficiencies and also in terms of the outputs, then we think that's consistent with the cost of equity that they've put forward. And now, so that's another way of looking at it. So I think that's that. So we think the decision that we're making in respect of WPD is consistent with the position with the slow track companies.
Another way of putting it, had WPD come in with a lower cost of equity assumption but higher cost assumptions but exactly the same revenue profile, we would have found that equally acceptable. So even if they'd done something extreme like a 4% cost of equity but rather higher costs, we might well have found that acceptable. It wouldn't mean that we were giving them any less than slow track companies.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. The next question comes from Lakis Anathu from Agency Partners. Please go ahead.
Hi, guys.
Hello.
Two questions. One, on page 4 of the document, three or four paragraphs down, you talk about the embedded cost of debt. I took that, it seemed to me what you were saying there is you were taking into account in your cost of equity assumption the fact that the cost of debt when taking embedded costs into account is higher than your debt indexation number provides, which seems to suggest that your cost of equity assumption isn't a clean number, if you see what I'm saying.
No.
But you're almost fatting into it for financeability reasons. And my second question is there seems to be an implication through all of this, and including also, I think, in the gas distribution review, where okay, higher returns, but very tight on financeability. That you seem to imply the companies need to achieve financeability through performance of some kind, rather than achieve financeability if they're in the mean, i.e. not outperform or underperform. Am I mistaken in that interpretation?
So if I just briefly answer the second one first, I think you are probably rather overstating that. And what I would say, it is for the companies to ensure that they manage their businesses so that they maintain comfortable investment grade ratings, and that we set them an allowed return that we think is sufficient to allow them to finance their businesses. And clearly how they do, they can do that either by the way they manage their balance sheets through outperformance or indeed through talking with the rating agencies or whatever other means that they wish to do that. So I think outperformance could well be a part of that package, but I think it's wrong to say that we're relying on outperformance to allow these companies to ensure that their businesses are financeable.
Yeah, and the intention is to provide a cost of overall cost of capital framework that is the right cost of capital. In other words, it doesn't overstate the cost of capital, and neither understates the cost of capital, and that provides a basis for confident investment by investors. I think it is then our expectation that companies should be able to finance themselves on that basis with a gearing ratio of 65%. But we're not fixed on a gearing ratio of 65%. That's our notional assumption for the purposes of price control. Some companies may not be and may feel that it's necessary to change their level of gearing. Other companies may feel that they can maintain that level of gearing or even higher. But that is effectively up to the companies. We are looking for companies to maintain, as Andrew says, comfortable investment grade credit ratings, and that remains the case.
Yeah, but your notional company should be financeable under your assumptions. And it seems to me you're trying to solve one too many equations. That you can give the return that allows financeability, and you can give the return that allows for being in line with the cost of capital. But the two aren't going to be the same. And if they are, it's accidental, particularly at the high gearing levels. Well, I think, you know, to stop beating about the bush on my part, I mean, it's just that with the gearing levels you're assuming, you're having to give an allowed return that is in excess of the cost of capital, and you're having to do that for financeability, even with the squeeze you're giving now. Is that a fair statement or not?
No, it's not.
If we change the gearing assumption, we wouldn't come up with a very different overall weighted average cost of capital.
But, that's not the case. Just to bear in mind that the various ratios that we may well, or the credit rating agencies may well look at for financeability, we don't see that necessarily as having to converge on the lowest common denominator through changing the cost of equity or the cost of capital. We don't see that as necessarily the approach. We put a cost of capital, as Ian said, that we think is appropriate to finance these businesses, and it's for the companies to work out what balance sheet, what business plan they need to put in place to ensure an investment-grade credit rating, and certainly talking with the credit rating agencies is potentially a key part of that. So in terms of what you say about the embedded cost of debt, I think also, once again, it's not simply, this is not a matter of, allowing pass-through of the cost of debt. What we're talking about here is a different way that we treat the embedded cost of debt. And indeed, the fact that we're using debt indexation rather than a fixed debt number effectively changes the risk profile and potentially leads to a different level of risk on equity as a result of that, which is not the same thing as saying that we're effectively allowing pass-through of the cost of debt through a higher cost of equity.
Is that right? I understand that.
Yep.
Thank you. The next question comes from Fraser McLaren from Merrill Lynch. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon. When you say that you're open to persuasion on the ROE for those in the slow lane, do you mean that if the companies can make a robust case on costs, that they could have the 6.4% ROE just like WPD, rather than have to argue the case on the ROE alone? And my second question is, could you just confirm that there is no way that you could reopen the rates of return on the T and the GD reviews, even if you were under political pressure to get returns down?
I could absolutely confirm that second one, that we're not going to reopen. I mean, the key part of the robustness of the regulatory framework is we don't revisit past regulatory decisions, even under political pressure. I think on we're not, just to be also absolutely clear, it's not that we are open to persuasion on the cost of equity, but you can imagine a situation where a company can provide a business plan which potentially is more ambitious and more risky and therefore may justify a higher cost of equity. I'm not necessarily inviting them to do that. But I'm just also saying that, it's up to the companies to produce the business plan. And also, the other thing is about it being a minded to It's just the fact that the final decision we have to make is sometime in the future, and quite a lot can happen between now and then. And we made it absolutely clear that if WPD accepts the reduction of 0.3, there will be, we end up giving a higher cost of equity as a result of events between now and when we have to make the final decision, that we'll have a sort of make good obligation for WPD, that they'll get any benefit from that, so they won't lose out by agreeing now to this lower cost of equity. So Ian, do you want to add to that?
No, I think that pretty much does it. I think we would probably draw a distinction between WPD and the others in that we were the particular circumstances, the particular context for a fast track decision was looking at the business plans in the round, taking their cost of equity and their other costs and taking those together. I don't think that context translates in the same way through to slow track. So as Andrew says, if there is a particular and more likely to be a risk-based justification for higher cost of equity, then there may be some scope for us to consider that.
And you may remember some of the discussions around the different levels of risk in the, or maybe you don't, in some of the transmission companies and relative to gas distribution. I think that's a good example of the sort of consideration that we might take into account. Where I sit today, it's not clear to me there's any distribution company with a particularly different risk profile to any other one, so it has to be a fairly compelling case.
Okay.
Thank you. The next question comes from Megan Darby from Utility Week. Please go ahead.
Oh, good afternoon. I hope you'll excuse me piggybacking on the investor call. I understand Hannah Nixon's on holiday and wasn't available for interview. I just a quick question about there's quite a disparity now opening up between this proposed cost of equity for DNOs and what's been allowed for National Grid, say. Is that fair, and are there any plans to sort of reopen other price controls
I've already said absolutely that there are no plans to reopen any previous price controls, and that was a different price control at a different time in different circumstances. Our job is to get the best for consumers in a way that's consistent with the company's being financed, delivering on their business plans in the context of the information we have at the time.
Okay. You were prompted to look again at cost of equity by this Competition Commission NIE determination. Can you explain why you've kind of adopted the quite aggressive line on cost of equity, but are kind of maintaining quite a tight line on the cost of debt as well, whereas they were a bit more generous? Can you just talk me through that?
Well, I get probably in to answer that, but I mean, just to say straight away, we haven't taken the cost of equity implied by the Competition Commission and just copied it over to the ED1. We have considered how the context difference between the Northern Ireland case and ED1, in particular in relation to the period of the price control, the 8-year period compared to 3 for the Competition Commission, and the different ways in, and particularly the different ways in which we treat the cost of debt. That's the reason why we've got a slightly higher cost of equity than is implied by the Competition Commission decision. I think it's also important that we provide good justification for these changes as well. So I'll just hand over to Ian if you've got anything more to say on that. But I think that's, we haven't just simply taken the CC's decision without thinking carefully about it.
I think on the cost of debt, I think it probably is fair to say the cost of debt index is inherently, I feel like, a sort of finer approach. tighter. That's mainly because we don't have to include, if you like, a sort of caution headroom within forecast cost of debt assessment for cost of new debt. I don't think we see anything inherently inherent difference between the cost of debt index and the returns the cost of debt companies will actually achieve. Now, clearly, some companies with old and expensive debt may find themselves out of pocket. Other companies will find themselves better than the benchmark, but it is a benchmark-based approach, and the point about benchmarks is that some companies win, some companies lose. As Andrew says, there is a risk aspect to that. Also, I'm not sure I would necessarily say the CC's approach was particularly aggressive, but our approach and the advice that we've received from our advisors is subtly different, and it's in that context as well. And in particular, as Andrew highlights, that we have a rather longer period over which to assess the cost of equity than the CC had.
It's all right.
Okay, thanks for that.
Thank you once again. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star followed by the 1 on your telephone. If you wish to cancel the request, please press the star followed by the 2. We now have a follow-up question from Jamie Tunnicliffe from Redburn. Please go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, how plausible is it, given today's decision, that a company could earn a double-digit return on regulatory equity and, say, a sort of 5% post-tax real return? And if so, can you provide an example of what would be required to hit that?
Is it plausible? The concept has always been that a well-performing company should be able to earn double-digit returns if they're performing well across the board. Now, clearly, other things being equal, the fact that we've reduced the cost of equity by effectively 0.3 as a result of this this decision means that the double-digit returns that we might have been measuring before are now 0.3% lower, so presumably there's a smaller chance of double-digit returns. But I'm not sure that's a sort of materially smaller a figure, given the sort of ranges that we get in terms of outturns for returns on equity. Would still see there being potential scope for companies to earn double-digit returns.
So just to be clear on that, we're not just talking about a well-performing company. The business plans the companies will have to submit will have to be demanding. So we're looking at a company that not only delivers on its business plan, but significantly outperforms on that business plan. I think I wouldn't want you to go away with the idea that the company just going through the motions and hitting its targets will earn a double-digit equity return.
I think that's absolutely crucial. The underlying idea is that a company really should be outperforming across a very wide range, and outperforming really well across a wide range of areas. It certainly should not be seen as an expectation that a moderately well-performing company should be able to earn double-digit returns, and that doesn't seem to me to be consistent with the underlying concept.
Well, it's worth saying, as we do have some journalists on the line, just to make it absolutely clear that in those circumstances, the consumers will also be benefiting significantly from that company's outperformance, both in terms of lower prices, lower operating costs, and value captured for future price controls as well.
Thank you. The next question comes from Ian Turner from Exane. Please go ahead.
Afternoon, everybody. If I'm a slow tracker, what do I do now? Do I effectively drop my business plan by 60 basis points or drop it by 30 and then go with the sort of RORE range of the WPD plan, assuming I'm kind of where I need to be on processes and outputs?
It's Anna Rossington here. In our consultation document and the draft determination in November and December, we recognised that the timescales would be quite tight for the companies between the timing of this decision and their resubmission of their business plans. At the time, what we suggested was that they would submit their plans using the reference point that we'd used at the time of assessing the plans of 6.3%, but that then they should consider what would need to change if we decided to adopt the Competition Commission position. Now, obviously, this decision now is a slightly different number, but we would expect the company's arguments to still sort of cover those areas. That said, if a company wants to actually reflect the outcome of our decision directly and can, you know, include that within its plan, that would be, you know, sort of more than welcome.
Thank you.
The next question comes from Edmund Reid from JP Morgan. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, guys. Two questions. The first one is whether your decision is dependent on the Competition Commission's final determination on Northern Ireland electricity. And the second is, what equity beta are you assuming? I think it's 0.9, but I couldn't be completely clear from the document.
Shall I pick that? Yes. No, our decision is not dependent on the final determination that we understand should be prepared by the Competition Commission in March, or at least be delivered to the utility regulator in March. We have assessed the evidence that the CC set out. We've reflected on that. We've received advice on that basis. We have made our own independent assessment of the appropriate cost of equity on that basis. Yes, so what was the second question there?
It was on the equity beta.
The equity beta. Yeah, there was an implied equity beta of 0.9 within our central reference point. Fundamentally, we're not changing our beta assessment as a result of this exercise. This exercise was focused on the question of whether we should give more weight to contemporary market evidence around the equity market return, and we haven't reviewed or revised our assessment of the beta.
Okay, so would it be fair to say it's around 0.9 or?
Well, that's what it was, so it would be fair to say that it remains there, yes.
Okay, and then follow-up question on that. In the sort of consultation responses, a number of the respondees have talked about actually observed numbers of 0.5, and obviously I think Ofwat have chosen a number of 0.8 for water. I just wondered how you kind of squared those things off.
Can I just say, we do indeed highlight in the report the differences between observed betas and our assumption. And all I can say is that this is one of a number of issues that we'd seek to look at further after ED1. I think we are producing an outcome here which is very much representing value for money for consumers delivering a basis on which companies can finance their business plans, and this decision in isolation is based on just looking at the Competition Commission's evidence on equity market returns.
Okay, thank you very much.
The next question comes from Martin Brough from Deutsche Bank. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks. Yeah, it was just, a follow-up to Ed's question around the equity beta, just to clarify what, if anything, you're assuming on the debt beta. Because it just struck me that it just seems implausible that investors in NIE debt at 3.4% return and DNO debt at, say, 2.5% return are taking the same beta risk. And I know you've said in the past, well, it doesn't make much difference what debt beta you assume. because it impacts on getting to an asset beta and then back again to an equity beta. But it does strike me you're using a higher looking forward estimate of gearing than the observed market evidence. So have you made an explicit assumption on the debt beta, and are you simply using the 0.1 that was assumed by the Competition Commission for NIE?
No, we've not made an explicit assessment or reassessment of the debt beta. I think conventionally we tend to assume a debt beta of zero, which is a sort of convenience. I think if there were to be, and we're recognising the cost of debt is higher in Northern Ireland, it's difficult to know how much of that cost of debt, the increased cost of debt, is exposure to, if you like, non-diversifiable default risk, and how much of it is, or at least sort of non-market related default risk, and how much of it is systematic. So I'm not sure we can sort of necessarily make a translation from relatively high debt beaters in Northern Ireland to where we are. We note the Competition Commission's assessment there, but I'm not sure we can sort of directly translate back. What we are simply doing is making a translation from the position that we held before to the position that we hold now on the cost of equity.
It just seems that the Competition Commission, you know, if you've taken their equity beta and further geared it to the 65% you're assuming, you would have ended up with an equity beta over one. So it seems a little bit harsh. You've just taken their evidence on the risk of the equity risk premium, but ignored what they were saying about the relationship between leverage and the equity beta.
I think we see nothing in the Competition Commission provisional determination that causes us to consider our beta assessment prior to the Competition Commission report being out of line. In fact, I think it was probably fair to say that the Competition Commission's assessment of the beta for NIE was with reference to the betas that we have been using in Ofgem. So there isn't a sense that the CC was in any way undermining or departing from our assessment, but simply reflecting the fact that in Northern Ireland there are specific risk issues, and in particular they highlighted the fact that there was a lack of less familiarity of the investor the markets in the regulatory environment in Northern Ireland. So we're seeing that as being a Northern Ireland specific issue rather than anything which translates back to any kind of reassessment of Ofgem's beta assumption.
I just struggle to reconcile a 0.9 equity beta with the Competition Commission assessment on utility asset betas and their approach to gearing. But I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think as Ian said, I mean, the last time we said anything in public about betas, I think, was at the strategy document.
Yeah.
We haven't said anything about that since. We have looked at the implications of the CC decision for the cost of equity, and that's what we're talking. That's what we're discussing today. I think as we say, there are a large number of issues that have been raised, not just on this, but other questions that have been raised as a result of this consultation, and we will have an opportunity to look at those in more detail after ED1.
Okay.
Thank you. The next question comes from Andrew Mulder from CreditSights. Please go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Just a couple of things I wanted to clarify, really. You've talked about comfortable investment grade rating on the call, but in the document today, you don't actually mention the phrase sort of comfortable. You just talk about investment grade.
Yeah, sure.
And in view of the sort of deterioration that you see in the interest cover ratios, I just wonder kind of where you draw the distinction. I mean, what's a comfortable investment grade as opposed to just an investment grade, say, BBB-? And just secondly, also on the issue of financeability, you talk about de-gearing, particularly perhaps through raising new equity. And I just wonder, in your consultation, presumably you spoke with some of the owners of these companies, and I just wonder how they feel about putting new equity into businesses where you're reducing the returns for them.
Right. Okay. Well, first, in terms of investment grade, I think we implicitly in our cost of debt index, we use a blend of single A and triple B investment grade bond yields as our starting point. So our expectations are that we will be looking for companies to be maintaining that kind of profile, and that's the assumptions that are behind our assessment. In terms of financeability, clearly de-gearing is one of the options available to the companies. I think owners might reasonably not feel comfortable about putting more equity in, but our assessment is around what is an appropriate cost of capital across the equity to charge consumers, and we believe that that is perfectly consistent in terms of the underlying risk issues that we see from the cash flows in these businesses. We don't see a fundamental reason why that should not be consistent with 65% gearing ratio, but we understand where the credit rating agencies come from, and therefore there may be a requirement for some companies to move. That is essentially between the companies and the rating agencies as to how they manage that process.
But then, I mean, how do you deal with the company where the owners say, we're not injecting more equity, and therefore we can't de-gear, so we can't meet the financeability? What does
In short, we believe we're providing a return on equity that's sufficient and commensurate with the risk that these investors are taking, given that they've got an opportunity to outperform the assumptions and the incentives are there to encourage companies to outperform so that benefits consumers, then it's difficult to see why anyone would be reluctant to provide new equity into these businesses, unless you can tell me that the cost of equity is below a level that's commensurate with the risk in these businesses, which I don't think it is.
Okay, we'll see.
We'll see.
Thank you. The next question comes from Jamie Tunnicliffe from Redburn. Please go ahead.
Yes, just following up on the 6% and how we interpret the individual components. A couple of questions, and you're saying you haven't changed the equity beta of the 0.9. You know, are we meant to just say that the only thing that's changed here is that equity market return? Essentially, you've knocked 40 basis points off it, therefore it's 30 basis points off the cost of equity given the 0.9 beta, and that you'll carry on doing the risk-free rate as you've done in the past, the equity beta as you've done in the past, et cetera, that it's only your view of the equity market return.
Can I just repeat what we said? I'll get Ian to answer the question directly in a second, but just to say, and we said this a number of times, that there are a number of issues that have come up as a result of this consultation, and we intend to look at those in more detail after ED1 process has been completed.
Yeah, I do understand that this decision may be slightly more difficult than some to interpret, because we haven't sort of set out in our nice little table exactly how we got there. And I think that is in a way deliberate. We've considered a wide range of issues and considered a wide range of arguments. We recognise that part of it may be a reduction in the cost of equity market return as effectively as we have interpreted the Competition Commission's position to be, but equally we have been advised by our expert advisors that there are, if you like, there is another dynamic here, which is that for businesses which are perceived in the markets as being relatively risk-free with observed betas lower than 1 and even lower than 0.9, that there is an influence around the risk-free rate that brings it down.
But you're saying you haven't taken that view with these guys, that you're assuming their equity beta is quite close to 1. It's 0.9.
Well, effectively, we're not changing our beta assessment. But I think in terms of reaching a view, I think we've recognizing that there's a number of different ways of getting to the same number.
Wouldn't it be better to stick to a consistent approach, which, as you say, you prefer to base yourselves on observable evidence, et cetera, and to be very clear about the components and how they're derived and how you got to this number, rather than saying it's sort of 6% and don't worry about how we got there because,
Can I just read you what the answer says in the document? Can I read you what we therefore consider that there are a number of factors pointing towards a lower cost of equity for the DNOs, in large part reflecting current market conditions as analysed by the CC. Okay? I mean, that effectively tells you the justification for making the decision we've made.
But Andrew, you just said in response that how we get there has been deliberately left fuzzy,
Because I think it would be dishonest of us to say that we have a specific single route to get to the number. It's actually more honest of us to say that there are a number of ways of getting to the same point.
Table 1 on page 14 of how you came up with the baseline 6.3 is pretty clear.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're not willing to do that now.
We could present a few different versions of that, all coming up with the same number. But I'm not sure that it's necessarily going to help anybody by fixing on one of them.
Can I just say something slightly more sympathetic to your point of view? I think we do recognise the importance of that type of information because it helps you understand where we might go next in response to developments in the market, for example. So I think we do understand that. And, that is one of the reasons why we're saying quite clearly now that there are a number of issues that we're going to look at in the longer term in more detail that have been raised as a part of this consultation. Yeah. And, I think it may well be, slightly unfortunate that you might have to live with a little bit of additional uncertainty there. But as ever, we strive, wherever possible, A, to be, as Ian says, completely straightforward and transparent about our reasoning, and secondly, to provide you with as much understanding of our thinking to enable you to understand where we might go next. And I think we've done all we can in that respect.
I'd say that maybe you should have taken a bit longer to come out with a clearer view. Would be my feedback to you, and I think that's sign of how short the consultation was in this case.
I think
your answers to the questions.
We could at this point make a preference towards one group of experts versus another group of experts, but I think the debate needs to take rather longer than we've got for RIIO-ED1.
There is two questions here. One is actually making a decision that we think is robust and for ED1, and I think we've absolutely done that. And the second is giving you as investors and indeed other stakeholders maximum visibility and transparency about our thinking, unless you take a view that you can never ever change your views on any of these things because you have to be transparent all of the time. When thinking is potentially in flux, then you have to be clear about that, and we're making it clear where we're that we will be looking at a number of the issues that have been raised as a part of this consultation after ED1 in more detail. Having said that, I think it's also pretty clear we're not, there's an awful lot about our methodology and our approach, including, a general tendency towards being transparent and open that we're going to continue.
Thank you. The next question comes from Dominic Nash. Please go ahead.
I actually was going to sort of follow up the question from Jamie with why haven't you got a sort of a table anywhere in it? And actually, I think that you can come up with any level of equity risk premium and beta and risk-free rate and get whatever answer you want. And I'm happy to have a conversation with Jamie offline on what the million permutations are. But the questions I've got on this one are, first of all, have you talked with Ofwat in any detail in here? Obviously, they haven't done an official submission, but I presume that you have, that Ofwat is kind of been involved with this consultation on this area. And secondly, just a quick sort of housekeeping one, what's the timetable going forward and what do we now expect from news flow on this?
Okay. First of all, with regards to our, we are having fairly regular discussions with Ofwat. they've not formally or even actually informally contributed or responded to this consultation. It's very much a matter of just being aware of what each of us are doing, recognising we're both undertaking reviews along a very similar timetable. On your question on timetable was in relation to what, to the more general
ED1? Yeah, the ED1, and I presume that the companies themselves, because the returns are going to be lower, are going to have to come back with different revenue profiles for their own sort of financeability, and when do we expect that, and when are you next actually going to be publishing anything?
So the DNOs resubmit their business plans on the 17th of March and have to publish them on their websites before the end of March. The next publication you will receive from us will be the draft determinations on those business plans, which we published late July of this year.
Just a day prior to that, we have the decision on WPD fast tracking, which obviously yes. depends on how WPD responds to this decision today.
Yep, and that's on the 28th.
I presume if WPD reject it, then their ROE is going to fall back to 6%, or that is kind of your reminder number.
They'll be part of the slow track process, so they'll be treated the same as any other company in the slow track.
Right.
But just to say, just to reflect our answer before, it's not that we have given WPD a higher cost of equity. It's that, taken in the round, we think that business plan represents good value for money for consumers, given the level of operating efficiencies and outputs that WPD is committed to.
Okay, thank you.
We have a follow-up question from Fraser McLaren from Merrill Lynch. Please go ahead.
Hello again. Just to be totally clear, earlier in the call, it sounded like you were emphasising that this is not a final decision, but it also sounds now like you've made your minds up that 6% is the number for the business plans. It's a bit reminiscent of water, is it not, where the business plans initially ignored the message from the regulator on the basis of being able to make the case, and then had to be told again that the regulator wasn't joking and that that's what the number had to be.
This is a minded to decision. It has to be that because we have to, we recognise that the final determinations won't be made for some time. The world could change in that time, and then there could be new evidence could be made available either by companies or by third parties or by events. And on top of that, as we said, it's for the companies to submit their business plans. I guess if they want, but that doesn't necessarily mean that, that they may in themselves put forward a higher cost of equity, but that doesn't change what we would consider as the appropriate reference cost of equity. They would have to make a good argument that they are somehow higher risk than everybody else. That's not quite the same as us changing our cost of equity, as I'm sure you understand. So, yes, I don't want to I think you understand what a minded to decision is in the regulatory context, I'm sure. It simply means that the final decision isn't made for another 12 months, and therefore things can happen and new evidence can come to light in that period. Is there anything else you want to add to that, Anna or Ian?
No, it's basically subject to further evidence that we might receive, which could include from the company.
So, in the absence of any further evidence, it is a firm decision. Is that fair to say? Another way of putting it, clearly, you would expect us to respond to any evidence that occurs between now and the final determination. It would be strange if we didn't.
Thank you. There are no further questions. Please continue with any other points you wish to raise.
That's all, and thank you very much. And, if you have any further questions that you want to take offline, then please direct them through Harry Rippon in the Investor Relations team. So thank you very much for listening in.
Thank you. That concludes the decision on RIIO-ED1 market return methodology. The call is now concluded. You may now disconnect.